Welcome to At the Organ, a weekly show about the classical organ and its music, heard on organlive.com every Sunday or streaming from our website anytime. Just point your browser to attheorgan.com for more information. Now, let's hear what's happening this week at the organ.
Hi, and thanks for joining me this week on At the Organ. In today's episode, we hear from organist and professor Gail Archer as she talks about her recent recordings and the music of Olivier Messiaen. Hello, and welcome to At the Organ. My name is Brent Johnson. This past week, the Episcopal Church of St. Peter in Lejeune, Missouri, a suburb just west of St. Louis, celebrated 10 years since the installation of their Mander organ. To help with the celebration, they invited Gail Archer to present a recital on the instrument. Dr. Archer is college organist at Vassar College and director of the music program at Barnard College at Columbia University. She serves as director of the Artist and Young Organ Recitals at Historic Central Synagogue in New York. Bruce Ludwig went out to St. Peter's last week and sat down with Gail in the sanctuary of that church to talk with her about her recent recordings and concerts and the music of Olivier Messiaen. He brings us this interview.
Could you tell us something about another project of yours, Mendelssohn in the Romantic Century? It's a collection of music by Felix Mendelssohn and other 19th century German composers.
Also, that was an anniversary project because Mendelssohn's 200th birthday was 1809, so in 2009. But I wanted to do more than play Mendelssohn's literature, of which, of course, there are the six sonatas and the three preludes and fugues and plenty of small pieces, adagios, andantes, lovely marches that he wrote for organ. Mendelssohn is not just a great composer. He's an organist, he's a pianist, he's a great conductor. He was the one who brought Gewandhaus to the international level and made such remarkably diverse programs for the orchestra to play. He had historical concerts. He was playing the Brandenburg Concertos of Bach. He was interested in Handel. So he's looking at the historical past with this wonderfully broad perspective. So he conducted a performance of the St. Matthew Passion of Bach, an abridged version, about an hour long, not the whole 3 hours of the Passion, which circulated in the German choral societies in the 1830s and 40s, sparked the Bach revival. So I wanted to trace all the way through the 19th century the organ literature that was inspired by Mendelssohn's rediscovery of the Baroque. So I played Mendelssohn's music, then I played BACH fugues of Robert Schumann, I played Clara Schumann's organ fugues, I played Fanny Mendelssohn's two pieces. His sister wrote an F major and a G major piece, one of which I played last night on the concert here. Then I played the Brahms 11 chorale preludes. I broke those up with a couple preludes in each of the concerts. And then finally, the big fantasies of Max Reger. Completely mad. Too many notes, lots of chromaticism. But interestingly, based many of them on the old German hymn tunes, on Wachtelhof, on Ein feste Burg, really familiar ground for anybody who was a Protestant churchgoer. Interestingly, Reger was a Catholic, but he was very well aware of that great body of German hymnody, German language hymnody, which of course is Lutheran. But many of the organ pieces are based on that literature. So it's this interest in the historical past that sparked a lot of these 19th century German composers to reinvestigate the counterpoint of the 18th century with their own harmonic sensibilities, which of course are very, very different. The chromatic language was radically different from anything Bach or Handel ever dreamed of.
Yeah, it's very interesting because it seems in this country often then you see the works of Bach receive a big billing on programs and then also the 19th century French masters. But somehow in the middle, these works seem to get lost, especially sad thinking of, you know, works, as you say, of Brahms and these smaller pieces too that have a wealth of inspiration that people might miss out on.
And the Brahms, I might point out that the 11 chorale preludes are the very last music that Brahms wrote. He knew he was dying of cancer in the 1890s, and in fact, there are two settings of O World, I Must Now Leave You, O Welt, Ich Muss Dich Lassen, in those 11 chorale preludes. It's poignant music, powerful music. they're gems, tiny miniatures, but Brahms is still these late great Brahms. It's wonderful, wonderful music.
Yeah, and I, to listeners that may be organists too, this repertoire is very interesting because you can use it on instruments that perhaps don't have a huge variety of tone.
Oh, absolutely. You could play it on a tiny instrument with 8 and 4 foot flutes, for goodness sake, and they would be just as effective. There are manualiter pieces, meaning just for the hands among that collection, or possibly you could play it with the pedals. There are lots of alternatives to those pieces. And yes, indeed, you don't need an enormous instrument to sing any of that music. It's very accessible.
And speaking more about the instruments for this particular recording, Mendelssohn in the Romantic Century, what were the instruments used and how were they chosen?
That's interesting. Because Mendelssohn's family was Jewish, his grandfather was the great philosopher Moses Mendelssohn, who was a philosopher of the Jewish Enlightenment, the Haskalah. His grandfather, Mendelssohn's grandfather, had 10 children, and very interestingly, some of them remained Jewish, some of them became Roman Catholic, some of them became Protestant. In Mendelssohn's own case, his father, Abraham Mendelssohn, and his mother, Leah Solomon, had the children, 4 children of the Mendelssohn family, all baptized before they themselves chose to be baptized and become Lutheran, because they wanted to integrate themselves into the society. Abraham Mendelssohn was a banker, and he just wanted to give his children the advantage of being part of what they felt was German, the mainstream of German Protestant Lutheran culture. So Mendelssohn's family are very intellectual. He painted, he drew, he had a very broad education in mathematics and science. So Mendelssohn's such a seminal figure here. It's the religious question, I guess, is one that has everything to do with how Mendelssohn created his life's work, because it's based on such a broad range of skills and interests. I'm fascinated with Mendelssohn, the Mendelssohn family. They really are, the women as well as the men, are fascinating people.
It must have been very interesting to have gained commissions internationally, for example, as if with the sonatas, and to sort of even be able to, recommission the commission to do these, even revise it a little bit.
Exactly. So I played, the answer to the first question is I played most of those concerts in the 2 great synagogues in New York for that reason. I played some of them at Central Synagogue and some of them at Temple Emmanuel. And both of these are Reformed synagogues in New York with great organs. Sebastian Gluck, who is a member of the congregation at Temple Emmanuel, restored the organ there. It's in mint condition in a grand, grand space. And Central Synagogue has a new kasavant that was put in 2004, a 4-manual kasavant with everything you could possibly imagine, including an echo organ in the front on the bima, so you can do these wonderful antiphonal effects in the sanctuary. So I played one of them at St. Paul's Chapel at Columbia, where I teach full-time, but all the other concerts were in the 2 great synagogues. And that was intentional because of the intellectual rigor of the family, the interests of the family, and the great respect of the Jewish tradition for learning in general. So I wanted to draw attention to Mendelssohn as a scholar as well as a musician. I thought playing at the great synagogues was a perfect choice. So a lot of the recordings that are up online from that project are played on the great synagogue organs rather than the church organs.
So the title of this recording, again, is Mendelssohn in the Romantic Century, and it deals some with inspiration of the circle surrounding Mendelssohn and maybe his successors. One of these of particular interest is Robert Schumann, who we think about more for perhaps his art songs or his works.
Piano miniatures.
Could you tell us some about these fugal and canonical works that are maybe somewhat unknown to people?
Absolutely. I got interested in them for that very reason. They're not played often, and they were originally intended for pedal piano. That's the interesting feature. Both Clara and Robert were living in Dresden in the 1840s, and they had a pedal piano in their home. The two of them were studying 17th and 18th century counterpoint together, and so Robert decided he would do some exercises and some short pieces for the pedal piano. But as I started playing them on the organ and using registrations. They're marvelously inventive and colorful and really a joy to play. And they're not the same. It's not a, he's taking that little B-A-C-H theme, but he turns it in such interesting directions, like the Waldseinen and the Kinderseinen, which I played as a young pianist years ago. He's just a marvelous pianist, as was Clara. And Clara was one of the great concert pianists of the 19th century. So he takes all that keyboard expertise and turns it to a pedal piano, but obviously they adapt beautifully as organ literature. And then we have the option of the registration to make the sections, colorful and contrasting, either more reeds or less reeds. And again, you can think orchestrally, because Mendelssohn, Schumann, Brahms, these are great symphony composers, and exploiting all the color in what was for them the modern symphony orchestra. So I think we gives us a free hand as organists to imagine on that same scale.
Yeah, one of the interesting things of all these schools, I think, is, as you say, that regardless of the genesis of the piece, for example, the Schumann canons with the pedal piano, or Mendelssohn with organ works, and even Brahms too, you hear some of the composer in this, but at the same time, it's a challenge to us organists to realize this on the instrument we're on, because you hear these pieces played on any sort of instrument with an abundance or a lack, maybe even, of resources, and the music is still very legitimate and always interesting.
I think one thing that organists need to do more is to open their ears to the orchestral music and the chamber music of these composers. We can be far more adventurous and audacious in our registration when you have some sense of the orchestration of their larger works, the Brahms Requiem, the great choral works. They all wrote wonderful choral music. They all wrote vocal music. I think you have to be well-rounded. Not so often organists are in a kind of niche where we're only looking at our own instrument, but I found it so instructive for my own growth and learning to know more about the literature of a given composer in the widest sense, because it informs how one approaches their organ music, or music that's adaptable for organ, like the Schumann pieces.
And this particular album is only available on MP3 download. And we were just wondering, how is this decision made? And what are the differences between this and a CD release that we might be more accustomed to with organs?
We chose to do this because I was playing on six concerts on the different instruments at St. Paul's, and then at Central Synagogue, and then at Temple Emmanuel. And all of that's live recordings. It's just right off my fingers. We decided we would just do a live release, and rather than doing it on a formal CD, we listened to the complete concerts. Everything I had done, we recorded every last note of it. And then I chose representative pieces that I was really happy with right off the end of my fingers. And some I was more happy with than others. And that's why that decision was made to just put it up online. It was just for fun. The truth is, we just wanted to take the best of what I had done live and then just put it up there for our own pleasure. Just to share the music with people. You can download part of it, all of it, none of it. It's entirely open-ended. But that was the reason. We wanted to just show the color of the instruments, the three instruments in New York. And I did pick off representative samples from all three instruments so that people could hear them.
So with the release of Mendelssohn in the Romantic Century, it was done as a digital release on the internet, a somewhat different concept, where takes are maybe a little more fresh. Can you tell us a little bit more about this maybe new wave in music recording and distribution?
I think it's a very good idea because it puts the performer on their best mettle. You really need to know your music and just have the sense of spontaneity, because sometimes when you're doing takes and takes and takes, you can get tired. There is a point, even for the most well-prepared and energetic performer, one can think of any number of wonderful improvisers, there really is a point where you're getting diminishing returns. So when you go out and just play fresh and live in front of a live audience, that's different than paying to an empty hall. I know that from the numbers of, I've made a number of recordings now, and there's a different kind of tension in the room. And I don't mean that in a negative way. It's a positive thing because you're trying to give something to the public and you're capturing that right in that spontaneous moment. And that is really different than a recording session where you could go over, okay, let's take it from letter A to letter C again one more time just to have another track to choose from. You know, the spontaneity is just there. And I think it's healthy for us as performers to be held to that standard, to just play as beautifully as you possibly can, right then and there. No second takes, just do it. And that's what we did.
It sounds very attractive because, you know, as life gets busier for everyone, then, sometimes it's harder for people to get to a live performance or harder for them even to go buy a CD. And so this is seems like a wonderful return because not only would this person benefit from hearing the recording, period, but they can hear it, as you say, in a fresh way, in a realistic way, one that would remind them of live performance. And then I suppose if they were so moved, then they could even donate to the performer as well.
Well, they could come to the, or they could just tell their friends and come to the next performance, because I'm always doing series of one kind or another.
You're listening to At the Organ.
The album A Mystic in the Making features two works of Olivier Messiaen, The Ascension and Le Cœur Glorieux. As the first American woman to play the complete works of Messiaen, what draws you to this composer's music in particular?
Well, that's a very easy question indeed. I'm a Roman Catholic, and the deep spirituality of this music was attractive from the beginning. The idea that he was so well-versed in Roman Catholic mysticism, he was interested in Eastern mysticism, certainly studied Hindu rhythms and Hindu melodies. He was interested in the spiritual life in the broadest possible sense, in the global sense, and I found that extremely attractive. There's so much Gregorian chant in Messiaen, and of course, all the wonderful bird song. He was an ornithologist. I found his incorporation of the song in the natural world extremely attractive. And he's so detailed about the registrations in the music. And of course, one can't replicate that on an organ here in the States because he's using his own organ at the Trinité to work out all of that detail. But he gives you so much information that you can actually synthesize, you can get close to what he intended the organ to sound like in various places in the music. And that's connected very often with the overall spiritual intent of the piece. He'll choose a Bible verse and then write or pick a verse from Thomas Aquinas, with which he was very familiar. The Mystery of the Holy Trinity is full of Thomas Aquinas references. So that's powerful for me. And I found it very inspiring to play in big cathedral spaces in New York. I played it on six different instruments all around the city. Played at St. Patrick's Cathedral, played at the Dominican Church, St. Vincent Ferrer. So I was playing in big Catholic spaces, you know, the stained glass windows and the sense of the stone and the grandness of the buildings. So that was very meaningful for me. I think the very first of those concerts, which was the Nativity of the Lord, that was at the Church of the Heavenly Rest, which is at 5th Avenue, 90th Street. But the stars lined up that day. I was married to an Englishman, and my son was baptized in the Episcopal Church. He was baptized at the Church of the Heavenly Rest. And I was playing on the last day, last Sunday of Christmastide that year, which was the Feast of the Baptism of the Lord, the 13th of January. So I'm playing the Nativity of the Lord on the Feast of the Baptism of the Lord in the church where my son was baptized. And he was sitting right over my left shoulder in the front of the sanctuary. I can't tell you what it meant to me. It was so powerful. It was just like all the stars and planets lining up, and the New York Times was there. It was really special. I may never have an experience like that. It was so connected to what I was doing musically and also powerfully connected to my personal life. It was very, very powerful indeed. To play Dieu parmi nous in that great space. And the Heavenly Rest organ is one of my favorite in New York. It's five manuals and just a splendid, splendid building. I went back and played one of the Liszt concerts there last spring, the that was the first time I'd been back since the Nativity. So I played the third Liszt concert there in April just last year. And it's a splendid place. I just feel really at home in that space.
Tell us a little bit, we are speaking about the Nativity here, which is a work by Messiaen that has many, many movements. One of the ones that you chose for this recording, though, the Ascension, is just four, correct?
Right, it's much
shorter.
Could
you tell us something, as you were speaking briefly, about the adaptations necessary for a more American instrument, and then also something about the spirituality behind these pieces, which is, as you say, I think such a key element, because hearing these in isolation, maybe as if one dropped in off the street, if they're not done in the correct context, it might be hard for some people to get into it. But upon knowing more about the repertoire, about Messiaen, about the specific maybe teachings of the church or things from the scripture, then the listener is able to really understand what he was trying to communicate.
Yes, I would agree with that, because in the Ascension, for example, the second movement, these serene alleluias of the prayers of the faithful reaching unto God, and actually the third movement, the transports of joy, that started out as an the whole thing started out as an orchestral piece. And then when he adapted the suite for organ, he said, no, the orchestral movement doesn't work. And he then wrote the third movement, which is the signature piece of that particular set, with the great crashing chords at the beginning. But the whole idea of being reborn and the idea of connecting to the world beyond ourselves is very much a part of that. And like a number of them, Mystery of the Holy Trinity also ends with this evocative, very quiet, very slow moving. Many of these great cycles don't end with a great cataclysm at all. They end with a prayer. And that is the case with the Ascension. The last movement unfolds. I'm counting 16th notes and 32nd notes to keep all those eighth notes from going too fast. You're actually counting more in the last movement of the Ascension than you are in the Transports of Joy, because that essentially sings itself. It's a great improvisatory thing. Your hands play the crashing chords and your feet respond, and it's a very physical piece, very, very physical. And you've got the whole organ on from 16 feet all the way up to the highest mixtures and little 1 foots, whatever birds you've got in the ceiling, you get them going for that piece, and all the big reeds. You've got the heavy artillery on your side. But then the last movement is just as slow, which is his... Even the Banquet Celeste, one of the very first pieces that he writes, it's very Eastern. It's music that's unfolding at the speed of your breath, just long, slow breathing, rather than at the mad Vivaldi pace, the mad rhythms at which so much Western music is unfolding. You can really hear the influence of this Eastern meditative, looking inside for the answers to questions that we have the answers already within ourselves if we only take time to stop and listen and look within. And I think that's those kinds of things I find very, very attractive, because our world is running by at such a rate of speed. And Messiaen's saying, no. Take time. And it also takes patience on the part of the listener for some of that, to understand that we do need to leave time in our lives for that kind of meditation and appropriate soul searching. I think it's not to chastise ourselves, but rather to find what's beautiful within ourselves and also within others. And a lot of Messiaen's music brings that to the surface and makes that a prime directive, if you will. I found it so spiritual playing all the music. I must say I was exhausted after the six concerts, but it was a so satisfying kind of exhaustion to be able to play and investigate that music. I know of people who've played the cycle like all in one day. They just play one cycle after the other, like a kind of Messiaen marathon. But I would respectfully suggest that may not be the best way to investigate this music. Playing it in six concerts that were separated by a month or 6 weeks each one, and having people follow me around as I did it, allowed them to think about it too. The concerts were an hour long. The only one that was longer was the Livre du Saint-Sacrement, which is an hour and a half. And I did take a break in the middle of that, about halfway through, took a 10 or 15 minute intermission. But the others, I played just the hour, And that was it. And then people, the audience, could think about, and I put all of the biblical references in the programs. They were in French, and then they were in English. And I wrote about the music so that anyone at the concert would know exactly what the focus of the composer's attention was at any time. I thought that was very important. But you couldn't overburden people with so much music in a marathon. I just don't think it works at all for Messiaen. You need time to think about what you've just heard and experienced.
As a listener, that I've noticed often with these concerts of works that include Messiaen is often the, as you say, the scriptural quotes that occur in each movement of his works are not present in a program, or other elements are not, or perhaps, as you say, the acoustic is not present, the best stop in the room, on the organ, that is. You know, these things are not there, and so somehow the picture is a little less complete.
And people cut some of the suites apart and will only play a couple of movements of it. And it's less powerful. It really is. I mean, there are some movements that can work on their own. I can think of in the Cor Gloria, the last three movements, you can kind of take those apart. The joy and clarity of the celestial bodies kind of thing. Some of those are tremendously jazzy pieces and do work individually. But you have to be careful because there is a powerful narrative thread. It's not just music standing on its own, just purely a lovely piece, sonata in F major. It's not like that. There is a narrative thread. And without the biblical verses, I think the audience is left a little cold and unprepared. It's a richer experience to know the inspiration that was, you know, powering the composer to say these things in a musical language.
Well, hopefully this is an auspicious sign for future recordings of Messiaen, since I believe the first organ recording in the U.S. to win a Grammy recently was a Messiaen recording. And so do you have any plans for future recordings of Messiaen works?
I don't right now because I'm busy working on the American project. And then I'm also working on the project for the year after that, which is 2013. I want to draw attention to women's music. So I've already commissioned a piece that's being written even as we speak for that series from an American woman in New York. And then I'm gathering pieces from women internationally. I will play some old music by women from long ago, from the Baroque. And there'll be 5 or 6 programs of women's music in 2013, all the way around New York on different instruments as I do each spring. So I'm not playing Messiaen right now, but you can be well assured that I haven't left him behind, and that I will return because I just feel so powerfully about that music. It was so meaningful to me personally that I would like to record more of it. Yes, that's the answer to the question is yes, but just not right this minute.
We'll have more of Bruce's interview with organist Gail Archer next week. Links to her website, as well as links to purchase recordings talked about, are available on our website. We'll also have a bit of video of the organist of St. Peter's talking about their Mander organ, and we plan to have that up on our website this week. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter, not only for news of updates to our site, but also for daily updates about organ history. You can find a link, again, on our website at theorgan.com. Special thanks this week go to Gail Archer, Bruce Ludwig, Bill Aitken, and the staff of St. Peter's Episcopal for their cooperation, and thanks to Greg Caldwell for production assistance. Thank you for listening to this episode of At the Organ. Please let us know what you think about it. You can email us at info@attheorgan.com, and if you want to join in the discussion about this show, visit our website, the address, attheorgan.com, where you can leave comments for us and our other listeners. I'm Brent Johnson, and I'll meet you here next time at The Organ.
You've been listening to At the Organ, a weekly look at the art and music of the classical organ. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. Send your email to info@attheorgan.com or just go to our website where you can comment on the show. There you can also hear this week's show again or find back episodes. The address is attheorgan.com. At the Organ is a production of the Organ Media Foundation. For more information about supporting the foundation or sponsoring an episode of At the Organ, go to organmedia.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll meet you here next week at the Organ.